House Water Environment Committee will come to order. We have two bills to consider today. We're going to have the public hearing on Senate Bill 644A first, and then we'll be going into the work session on 2010. I expect about a half hour each, and here is our main testifier. Brendan, could you come forward for 644? I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 644A. And have the staff read the summary one more time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 644A permits the Water Resources Commission to establish by rule and expedited notice and waiting period requirements the substitution of supplemental ground water right for primary water right during a drought. This allows water right holder to enter into optional agreement at any time prior to declaration of drought emergency to use existing permit of right during certain drought periods. Provides that after approval of option or agreement by commission, holder of option or agreement may use transferred right to replace water not available to holder because of the drought and declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Brendan, I wanted you to come today, and we do have on our sheet what the dash 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 11s do, and now we have a 13. Do you mind just walking us through this briefly and taking questions from the committee?
No problem, Madam Chair. Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel, for the record. Let's start at the fives. The A5s allow local governments, public corporations, or water right holders to purchase an option or agreement to use somebody else's existing permit or water right. That's the basics of that. There are some details as to what they have to do when they do purchase an, or arrange to purchase or a permit or water right. That is significantly different in scope than some of the other amendments that we do have. Any questions on A5? Okay. The sevens relate to drought as well, I believe. The fives relate to drought. The sevens allow a temporary transfer and a type of use, and I believe place of use, for a period not to exceed 5 years, or transfer and a type of use for not to exceed 5 years, and a place of use or temporary transfer of the type of use for one irrigation season under certain circumstances.
And what was it? Can you tell me what was the reasoning for the 5 years?
Madam Chair, I do not know. It was language that came to me. I believe that was in, if I recall correctly, the original House Bill 3958. And that has been something that has carried forward. Let me see. Actually, that's existing language. I've just moved from the end of one. There's a renumbering there, so that's,
okay. That
hasn't changed. There are civil penalties which get picked up at the end of the A7s for not performing certain obligations or using water. I believe that's using the water concurrently. So it would be if you're using water on lands to which you're transferring it to and on the lands which it's transferred from in the same irrigation season, there would be a civil penalty for that.
Is that in Section 7?
That is in Section 6, Madam Chair, and in Section 7.
Okay. Then Section 8 does what?
Section 8 is a savings clause or an applicability clause which applies to the changes that are made, saying that these changes apply only to petitions that are filed on or after the effective date of this act, because there may be petitions for transfers and type or place of use that are ongoing with the department at the moment the bill passes, and so this is just specifying to which applications would apply.
Okay. Questions on the dash seven? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The A9s are essentially Senate Bill 17. I believe you had testimony this morning that described the impact of this concept. Essentially requiring a specific bond amount for staying determination of the Water Resources Director, but only for if that water right is for irrigation. So the people this morning more ably described it than I would be able to at the moment.
Question on the dash nine. Okay, and the dash eight, I believe we skipped, and that was the
I'm sorry. That's right, Madam Chair. The dash eights contain a sunset. They contain the essentially the A sevens with a sunset for the for all of the provisions of the A sevens.
Okay.
And the A11s, or are we doing the 10s as well?
No.
Okay, the A11s pick up a fee requirement in the existing bill that would, or could pick up a waiver of the fee requirement for temporary, I believe 536.0501L is for temporary transfers and type of use. So there would be I don't recall the amount of the fee, but that's what that does.
Are we doing 12?
And the 12s and 13s are nearly the same as the 7s and 8s. However, there are a few small differences made in them, primarily which would be in the Section 4, which would amend 540-570. The differences between that and the A7s, Section 4, which amends 540-570, can be seen in subsection 2. And I believe it's really I believe that the A12s and 13s are probably a little bit cleaner than the 7s and 8s. Rather than in the 7s and 8s where we have a district notifying the Water Resources Department of an intent and then submitting a petition, we just have the district submit the petition, which seems to me to be a cleaner and smarter way to do things. So I think that's a good fix.
Okay.
And then 13s, sunset everything in the 12s.
Okay, questions on any of these amendments? Everybody got it? Thank you very much. Great job.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Is there anybody else to testify on this that has not testified previously today? Okay. Close the agenda. Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before Brendan gets away, Section 10 of the dash 13, is that just to make the old language come back at a certain point?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, yes, that is part of the sunset provision. When we sunset statutes that are currently in existence that we've amended, we can't do it merely by a sunset clause, but we do have to show all of the language that would change at the time the sunset occurs. So that's why we have repeated the 54570 as amended by Section 4 of this 2001 Act is amended to read. So it contains essentially in bracket and italics what was bold-faced in Section 4 and then bolded what was in bracket and italics in Section 4.
I have a follow-up, Madam
Chair. Follow-up.
On page 15, on line 15.
Are we on the dash 13?
Yes. This would appear to apply to a proceeding under adjudication which has not actually been adjudicated and therefore would have ramifications in the Klamath Basin. Can you tell me what this language would actually do in the Klamath Basin?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, I can tell you that that would be what the existing language is. Those bold-faced, the and the proceeding, exist currently in statute. As to its effect in the Klamath Basin, I am not sure, but I would be happy to look into that for you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 644A, and I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 644A.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I move the A5s and the A12s to Senate Bill 644.
Representative Morgan moves the A12 amendment and the A5 amendment to Senate Bill 644A. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
I don't know.
Take a moment to read every word.
I guess, Madam Chair, one of the things that concerned me all the way through this is the rights of water right holders outside the district and how they are protected, and I guess I would need to know if that is addressed in either the 5s or the 12s.
Could Brendan come back up and answer that question, please?
Wow. Where's he from above?
Once again, for the record, Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I'm sorry, Representative Cruz, I was
okay,
missed your question. If you could please repeat it.
Madam Chair, I guess one of my concerns all the way through this is the rights of water right holders that aren't part of the district. For example, if something is happening here that authorizes a transfer of water to a junior water right to somebody outside the district that may be harmed because of this transfer and their lack of ability to the water. So I'm just wondering if anything in any of these addresses that sort of issue.
Representative Cruz, Madam Chair, I really
Section 4 talks about
if there's a
this is in the 12.
Can you tell what you're referring to, Representative Lee?
Section 4 of the dash 12 talks about no injury to any existing water rights. That was added in the dash 6 and the dash 12.
Section 4.
Representative Lee, that isn't just referring to water rights in the district. That's all water rights.
All water rights.
Well,
any existing water rights. Maybe Tom Beiler, if he's here, can speak to that.
Tom, please, if we'd call Tom up.
Tom Beiler, please.
Hello. Chair Close, members of the committee, Tom Byler with the Water Resources Department. There is an injury provision, and it does provide an opportunity for any water right holder, whether they're inside the district or outside the district, to claim that a proposed temporary transfer would be injurious to them. This is a fundamental bedrock provision and protection that we have in any type of transfer, and that opportunity would exist through this proposed legislation as well.
Okay, I guess, Madam Chair, I know that's always existed. I just want to make sure there wasn't something in here that was raising the, changing the standard.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I know Mr. Byler would never let us do that.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor. Are there further comments? Representative Morgan, do you want to restate your motion?
The motion is to move the dash 5 and the dash 12 amendments into Senate Bill 644A.
Okay. If there is no further discussion, is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I move Senate Bill 644A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan moves Senate Bill 644A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just need some clarification from those of you who know the water issues regarding why a sunset amendment is not needed. That was covered in the 12th and the
8th. The way it was explained to me is that we could revisit this next session if we needed to. We didn't need a sunset clause. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, and I was one that brought the sunset amendment forth. There were others who had some concern about it, and I'm not uncomfortable at all with this because with the sunset amendment, it would be reviewable in a couple of years, and without the sunset amendment, with any problems that appear there, since there are some of you who are first-year people, I assume you'll be back in a couple of years and you'll be able to bring it back and revisit the issue at the point if you do see there are problems.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Cori? Aye.
Representative
Keene?
Is excused.
A very uncomfortable aye.
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 Both aye. Motion carries. Representative Jensen will carry the bill.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Cruz's discomfort is at least part of the same that I have, and especially in light of the fact that we won't be here, unless there are dramatic changes to watch over this bill. Our heartburn area gets more intense than some.
Yes, it does.
Representative
House. I just wanted to say that on the very first day of this committee, when we were talking about orientation, I said that on water issues, I was just going to follow Jan Lee's lead. And on the very last day of committee, that's what I did.
Okay. Well,
what about in between those two days?
We can't be experts on everything, Representative Hass, so we're doing the best we can here. Thank you all for bearing with us on that bill. It was a difficult bill. Okay, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2010. I'm going to call forward Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council and Paul Warner from the Department of Revenue. And we have some new amendments, committee. We are up to the dash 11. We have the dash 10, dash 11. I believe you've seen the 9s. This is your chance to ask Mr. Johnson any questions you have on how this will work. Do you want to give us a summary of the amendments we now have that are pertinent? Some of them are no longer pertinent.
Madam Chair, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office.
I guess what I'll do is simply mention the differences between the dash 10 and the dash 8 amendments that I believe you heard the last time this bill was up, and that is basically two. One, in the dash 8 amendments, there was authority to distribute privilege tax revenues to the Department of Environmental Quality for orphan site cleanup. That has been eliminated from the dash 10 amendments. And the other change is in section 20 of the bill, and which is the distribution section where privilege tax monies are distributed to local taxing districts. And in the dash 8 amendment, the taxes went to the county in which the environmental cleanup district was located, and also to the school district located within the environmental cleanup district, but only to the extent that voters had authorized temporary property taxes called local option taxes. In the dash 10 amendments, the county no longer receives privilege tax revenues, and the school district receives privilege tax revenues for both its ordinary property tax, what it would otherwise receive if the property in the environmental cleanup district were not exempt from tax, and also the local option tax part.
So is it my understanding that we need both the 10s and the 11s?
Madam Chair, the 11s are an additional amendment that basically just amends one section of law. It is, unfortunately, it's the state school fund formula, so it's a very large section. But what it does basically is to treat privilege tax revenues distributed to the school district as if they were property taxes for purposes of computing the state school fund grant that each school district would receive.
Questions for Dexter?
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Could you take another stab at explaining the dash 11 to me?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan. I guess maybe to start out with, I should explain the school fund formula in general. And basically what the formula does is to compute for each school district in this state a gross grant that that district will receive for a biennium. And from that gross grant amount is then subtracted property taxes that the school district collects through the property tax system, so that the net amount they receive is from the state, from the general fund, is goes up and down depending on the amount of property taxes that the district collects. What the dash 11 amendments do is to treat the privilege tax as if it were a property tax for purposes of computing the state school fund grant. So it increases the local revenues. That's a defined term that basically means the property taxes, but it increases that by the privilege tax dollars that the school district gets, and thereby reduces the state school fund grant that the district would receive.
I understand. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Warner, would you present?
Yes. Madam Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I prepared a revenue impact statement, and I've referred to House Bill 2010-10, but I talked with Dexter about the dash 11, so I'm aware of those, and those would not affect this statement, so they would be exactly the same. Essentially, what I've done is assume the $10.1 million privilege tax maximum, which is in the bill. That would be a maximum for the entire amount. And there would also be an individual cap, which is based on the 2002 individual taxpayers' property tax liability and adjusted 3% per year. We have gone back and looked at properties we could identify, looking at what the city had done in their study and going directly to the county assessor. And we think that in 2002, those properties affected with a consolidated rate of 0.01595, that would include bonds, would generate about $16.8 million. So that would leave with a privilege tax of $10.1 million and a cap of 16.8, you'd have 6.7 in property tax collections after the privilege tax has been paid. The bill does, in Section 24, have a special assessment ratio of 0.4, and where that came from was really an effort to simulate that $6.7 million. So you'd be able to raise property tax at the 40% specially assessed rate to generate $6.7 million. In other words, to simulate what property taxes would have generated if they would have been in place. The other piece of the bill that raises the privilege tax goes into a tax. The privilege tax's base is on gross receipts, and those gross receipts are apportioned back to the owners. It's not a lien on property. It's the owners of the property within the district. And we have done some admittedly pretty rough calculations with the Department of Revenue as to what the gross receipts rate would have to be. They have identified 57 corporations with gross receipts data out of 303, but that accounts for roughly 89% of the property value. So even though they haven't identified tax returns for a very high percentage of the total, it's most of the value of the property. Therefore, the major companies there that would consist of most of the gross receipts there. Those companies had total gross receipts nationally of about $103 billion. So we would look at this the same way we do a corporate income tax. You'd apportion that amount back to Oregon, and it's about $3.3 billion for Oregon. And just for purposes of coming up with a rough estimate, we don't have precise data for within the district itself, but assume roughly 40% of that Oregon apportionment is within the district, because that would be where the property and payroll would be for those companies. That's their production centers. If indeed that's the case, and you were to assume a 1% a rate on gross receipts apportioned back to the special district, you generate about $13.3 million. So we think that would give you a surplus. But again, those numbers are, we don't have real solid data on them. And of course, the bill itself builds in a refund mechanism. So if you generate more than $10.1 million, there would be a refund paid to those companies in the next year. On the revenue impact statement, so you know really what you have $10.1 million raised in privilege taxes by the district, and then you have a corresponding reduction in property taxes of $10.1 million. And what I've done on the impact statement is show the imposed tax rates for the taxing districts. The city, of course, is 4.47 per thousand. Multnomah County is 4.86 per thousand. The Portland Public Schools are $5.15 per thousand, and that includes the Portland local option tax. So, so on through ESDs, Portland Community College, Metro, and Port of Portland. The bill also contains a distribution of privilege tax funds to certain districts that lose property tax revenue from the privilege tax replacement. And those are the Portland Public Schools, including the local option. So the Portland Public Schools would lose about $3 million in property taxes and about $337,000 for the local option, so about $3.3 million Portland Public Schools, and that would have to be reimbursed out of that privilege tax under the bill. We also think there would be about $59,000 reimbursed to Metro, because Metro is a special district that's not a PRP, as specified in the bill. So all totaled, we think that the privilege tax could raise $10.1 million with a gross receipts rate of around 1%, and it should raise more than $10.1 million. And property taxes would fall by $10.1 million. About $3.4 million of the $10.1 million would then be used to reimburse primarily Portland Public Schools. So there would be a net of about 6.6 million to the district after they reimburse these other districts that they have to reimburse their lost property taxes.
How will we determine the administrative expenses for the revenue department?
The Department of Revenue will estimate what those expenses are. They are specified in the bill as providing some direct recommendations on what rate should be used. There's some language in there for the department to send out an informational return to the taxpayers so they can get a sense of what the level of gross receipts are. They can estimate what that rate is. The department would then estimate what those administrative expenses are, and that would come out of the privilege tax. So there wouldn't be any additional revenue there. It would come off the top in terms of the privilege tax.
Okay. Questions? Representative Half.
Paul, is that 6.6 million the leftover amount, what would be used for actual cleanup? Is that what you're referring to?
Representative Hass, yeah, that I'm not the best one to answer that question, but the 10.1 is the total collection, and we're saying that 3.4 million plus whatever administrative expenses there are would come off the top. So it would be the maximum amount available for the cleanup.
If I can, Madam Chair, the schools would be made whole again, but the other local governments would not be?
That is correct.
Follow-up.
I assume you're confident then because with all of these changes to property tax laws that this can be done statutorily and that doesn't require a constitutional fix?
Madam Chair, Representative Hass, yes. The tax is not imposed on property. The privilege tax is not imposed on property. In order to be subject to the tax, you must, one, be an occupant of property in the district, not an owner. If you're merely an owner, you will not have, and you don't do anything except own the property, you will not have any privilege tax liability. Number two, you must have gross receipts, so it doesn't matter what the value of the property is. It's the value of, it's the gross receipts you incur during your income tax year that would be subject to tax.
Madam Chair, Representative Hassan, I might also add that the apportionment formula is different than what we have under current law for apportioning corporate income. It's just a portion on the three factors, payroll, property, and sales, and they're equally weighted. So in terms of the taxpayers affected by this, the overwhelming proportion of their privilege tax burden would be determined by the amount of property and payroll that they have within that district.
On
that property assessment, if you have, I mean, some of the arguments here are this is contaminated, it's a Superfund site, and therefore the property is worthless. How would you then, if the appraisal is zero or close to zero, wouldn't that be an unfair appraisal?
Now, one of the great uncertainties in this, Representative Hass, is what's going to happen to those property values. I mean, you can make the case that if there are some benefits derived from cleanup, they could go up, or you could, whatever is discovered there in terms of potential liability, those values could go down considerably. But the way the bill is written, that privilege tax base is defined the residual property tax amount is defined as that 40% specially assessed value, and then that grows 3% a year. So it's not directly tied to market value until the point where property's fallen so low that it's enough to offset the privilege tax. So only at that point would you come under Measure 5 and compression. So properties would have to fall quite a bit for that to be the case. But if they fall, if properties fall, then the cities or the taxing districts could conceivably be reimbursed more than they would have gotten if those properties were in place. But again, that's a major source of speculation, what will happen to the values of those properties under current law.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Hass, one point there, though. Whether or not the real market value will cause the property to decline in value, whether, I should say, whether the environmental liability will cause the real market value of the property to decline so much that it would cause the value to be less than the specially assessed value will affect the property taxes that right now are under the bill will be subject to special assessment. They will not affect the privilege tax. Again, because that is not a property tax.
Well, one other thing I might add here, too, if you're thinking about some of these properties, industrial properties, they are properties that don't turn over. I mean, they're not usually those that are valued based on market transactions. They tend to be based on income or cost, replacement cost estimates. So it's a little different kind of an assessment and appraisal than you would see under other types of property that have active markets.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Committee, we did have one person left over to testify when we last had the hearing, so I'm going to call Lori Wimmer Whalen up to give her comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen of the Oregon Education Association. We represent 43,000 school employees in both Oregon's K through 12 public schools and also community college faculty. And I want, first of all, to thank you for the dash 10s that appear to have helped school districts with respect to the $3.6 million per year impact on the property tax. But I did want to find out, establish some clarification and legislative intent with respect to a couple other pieces that are found in Section 20 that we believe are still not quite right. Our first question, I think, was answered by Legislative Council on page 12, Section 20, Sub A.
I'm sorry, which dash?
We're looking at the dash 10s.
Thank you.
Page 12, Section 20, Sub A, the reference to a common or union high school district, the comment was made for the record that that is to include the property tax revenues as well as the local option revenues, but it doesn't say that here, and I just wanted to reiterate for the record that's what was intended, despite the fact that it's not what it says. On page 13, sub B, all the amendments have had this problem. An education service district that imposes a local option tax, well, as far as we know, ESDs are not granted the authority under law to levy a local option tax, and so unless it's a prospective anticipation that that is a right that is yet to come in some future legislative session, I just wanted to bring that to your attention. ESDs do not levy a local option tax under Oregon law. And both B and sub C with community colleges, both the way the syntax of the sentence reads, it is a district that imposes a local option tax will be reimbursed. Does that mean that it is only that amount that is the local option tax, or is it that if you are a district that levies a local option tax, you get your property tax and your local option tax revenues reimbursed, or is it that, and then conversely, if you do not levy a local option tax, you get neither? I would, of course, be concerned that that means, for all intents and purposes, that those are gifts without any substance, because in the case of community colleges, their local option authority is very limited. It is only the amount that is between Measure 5 rate and Measure 50 that they can go out for a local option under current law, and frankly, no one pretty much does because it's so small an amount, it's not worth it. So it's a little like saying rich and poor alike are prohibited from sleeping on park benches. It's not much of a gift unless you're giving them back their property tax revenues. And so we would like to see that clarified for the record and perhaps improved. Thank you. I brought someone up with me, too.
Good afternoon. My name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm with the Portland Public School District. And again, there were clarifications made to A in Section 20, and we want to reiterate that those clarifications are what we believe is supposed to happen, and it's not really very clear in here. And obviously, we care very much about our education service districts and want them fully funded back, and because they don't even have local option taxes. So, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, just in a general way, that the City of Portland and Multnomah County and Portland Public Schools are partners in Portland, and we have a lot of things that we partner with: school, police, parks, community schools. And just for the record, from Portland Public Schools, I'd like to say that anything that hurts them and their tax base could possibly hurt the kids of Portland if they don't have enough money to continue their partnerships with us. So I'd just like to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes the people that we invited to testify in the work
session. Madam Chair.
I'm Representative Morgan.
I move the dash 10s and the dash 11s into House Bill 2010.
Representative Morgan moves the dash 11 and dash 10 amendment into House Bill 2010. Is there discussion? Representative Kefouri.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I guess I still have a couple questions. It's taken me a minute to digest these. So in these amendments, the intent is that Portland Public Schools is held harmless, but Multnomah County and the City of Portland and these other affected jurisdictions are contributing then to this fund.
That is my understanding. Mr. DeLorenzo, do you want to come forward? Could you answer Representative Kefouri's question?
Madam Chair and Representative Kefouri, that is my understanding of the Dash 10 amendments with one proviso, and that is that in addition to being held harmless, the Portland Public Schools receive a kind of insurance, too, because if the proponents are right that there will be declines in market value of the properties, the cities and county will lose money no matter what. Whether the legislature adopts this bill or not, but the city of Portland would be not only held harmless through the backfill, but would also be insured against any potential market decline, because they would then be receiving their amount through the privilege tax. So it's an extra plus for the schools.
Follow up. So you said the city of Portland, but you meant to say Portland Public Schools.
Pardon me. Portland Public Schools. I apologize. Portland Public Schools will be held harmless and will also be insured against this market declination by this procedure. The City of Portland, Port of Portland, Multnomah County will lose about 60% of the property tax revenue produced within the district, but we believe that they would lose a substantial portion of that anyway. What they will gain, of course, will be a pot of cash at the rate of $6,600,000 per year, which will be invested and then will go to pay for things that the City of Portland and others are jointly and severally liable for anyway, much of which includes material that was added to the river during World War I.
I know from I get confused, you know, schools are in, counties are in, schools are out, counties are out. At one point, you talked about the City of Portland, you believed should be a player because they were a PRP, is that the correct acronym for that? So what then is your rationale for Multnomah County? I know at one point they were out of the, or they were reimbursed for their funds, and so how come they are going to lose, although they are not a PRP?
Madam Chair, Representative Kefouri, first of all, the Dash 8s, which I spoke to last time we met, reflected what we had heard from the work group, and I believe there was a good rationale in excluding Multnomah County. That was, in fact, our proposal to you. There subsequently arose concerns by members of the committee as to why the schools were not better defended. I believe that either rationale can fly, so to speak. I think one rationale for including Multnomah County is that a good component of this soup dates back so long. You know, the question is, of the polluters who should pay for what? They should pay for what they've done. I think a good argument can be made, though, that the residents of Multnomah County for years and years and years enjoyed the benefits of low-cost goods and high employment, things that came along with many of the industrial activities that took place in that part of the river during those years. And so I think one can prepare a fairly decent rationale for including Multnomah County as part of this. But to answer very quickly, my first proposal, the proponent's proposal, was the dash eights. You now have before you the dash tens. I can live easily with either one. My preference was the dash eights, but I certainly understand the concerns of members with respect to their local schools.
Follow up. You refer to the soup, which I'm assuming is all the stuff in the river, and that some of the materials date back to World War I. Do you know, and you said a large percentage, do you know if that's true, or do we have studies yet that should tell us how much is since World War I and how much of it is from, you know, 2 weeks ago or whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative Kefouri, I cannot tell you with great certainty or quantify the amounts of contaminants in the river. I can tell you, though, that the reference to World War I came from the city's own website concerning the river. It's something that the city has at least put into public circulation. I believe the city is correct. I know Kaiser Shipyards for years during World War I built ships. During World War II, they built Liberty ships. There were significant activities ongoing during that, in that segment of the river, all of which benefited the local community and the Portland metropolitan area.
Follow up. In previous amendments, the fund, the it must have been before with the privilege tax, but would the privilege tax still not take effect until all the different studies are done, or does this privilege tax go into effect immediately? How does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Kefouri, in this version, in both in the dash 8s and the dash 10s, the privilege tax would take effect right away. The property tax exemption would take effect right away. One of the things that happened during the work group was at least our general discussion about whether or not such a district could bond. And so during the last work session you had, we made it clear that we had changed the emphasis away from bonding and towards creating a savings account. To create the savings account, though, one must begin funding this contingent liability. You know, I might say that there are many contingent liabilities which the City of Portland has, many of which are not funded. This is an attempt to begin funding such a contingent liability, and so that's why we took that direction. But yes, the answer to your question is yes, the privilege tax would take effect right away. But it would not be distributed for 5 years or so until the record of decision was published, and then under very constricted requirements and by a board that better reflects the community.
Follow up?
Last one.
How did you come up, you may have already talked about this and I may have missed it. How did you come up with the $10 million figure, and do you have knowledge that the money that's going to be raised from this fund is going to be enough to make significant change to the makeup of the water in the river?
Madam Chair, Representative Kefouri, as to your first question.
So that was just a two-part question of
okay.
The same question.
As to part A of the same question, pardon me, as to part A of the same question, the idea was to raise about $30 million or a fund that could grow to $30 million over 5 years. To do that, we needed to raise about $6 million, but there was also the backfill mechanism that needed to be included. Well, you add all those backwards and you get to about $10 million, which incidentally creates a situation in which a 60% or so property tax reduction within that area can fill the bill. And a privilege tax limited to $10.1 million can also fill the bill. So that's basically how that calculation worked. With respect to part B of your question. I think the people are all over the board on how much this will cost. Some feel that the bulk of the work will be to the soup. So, you know, $60, $70 million. Some feel that once all of the interim actions are complete by those parties to whom responsibility can be attributed early, that the soup itself will not require more than $30 million because many of the sources of ongoing contamination will be cut off, and other biodegradation, you know, the river flushing itself, things like that may also come into the mix. So no one really knows. The point is $30 million is nothing to sneeze at. And because the board is not going to be able to fund each and every item of the work plan, because the board can only fund those items where there is true joint and several liability and no one originator is easily identifiable, $30 million will be a substantial contribution to the to that phase two of the cleanup. And I think will get us a long way towards making our river much cleaner.
Further questions or discussion? The motion on the floor is to move the dash 10s and 11s into House Bill 2010. I'm going to have the clerk call the roll on this.
Aye.
Aye. Is excused.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries.
Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I move House Bill 2010 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan moves House Bill 2010 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I'm
Representative
here.
Hass.
I first of all want to say my hat's off to Mr. DiLorenzo for raising this issue and looking at this from a different perspective. And I thank him for that. I would personally like to have more time to digest this and see if there's a way to expedite cleanup process, not just in the Portland Harbor, but the other four or five sites around Superfund sites around Oregon. If the goal was to expedite cleanup, though, I don't see how this bill would do that. If the goal was to minimize litigation, I don't see how this bill would do that. I don't really see how the people of Oregon benefit from what we have here. And I wish we could spend more time, maybe during the interim, looking at ways to achieve the goals that Mr. DiLorenzo set out.
I know this is a complex subject, and we this committee has simply run out of time. But your concern is noted. Further comments? Representative Monasanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that there are some assumptions. We're passing a bill where there are quite a few assumptions being made. First of all, I would have preferred to have already had an analysis of the harbor sediments. I think that most of the sediments, or that at least most, if not all, of the contaminants of concern to EPA today didn't even exist until well beyond World War I. And I also think that the CERCLA process already considers and probably factors into its final assessment whether a property owner contributed or did not contribute to the soup. And finally, I have a problem that the property owners in the harbor aren't paying $1 more than they already are right now for cleaning up the soup. So that's basically the reasons why I can't support the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize that our committee has run out of time, and that's why we're taking action on it, but I, with all due respect, don't think that that's a good enough reason to pass out a piece of legislation that has had some very major and drastic changes since the beginning of. I know that the folks who have worked on this bill probably feel like they've been working on it for for a long time, but those of us who are being asked to vote on it today have just seen these amendments a few hours ago. And this is a pretty drastic change from the original bill, which we had a lot of testimony on earlier in the session. So I think any time that you're going to embark on such a major step in right or wrong direction, I don't know. I think that I personally, before I could vote on it, would need to have some more time to digest this. So I'll be voting no.
Steve Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm going to support the measure today. There is possibility that I might not support it on the floor when it gets there. I've heard a little bit of the reasons that some of my colleagues here have expressed, that there's an awful lot here and some digesting that I need to do. But I'd like to thank Mr. DiLorenzo, and I'd like to thank the people who worked very hard on the amendments to this. It's refreshing to me that we have people yet in our society that are willing to step out and try to do some things a little differently than we've done them in the past. And just because we've never done something, you know, not to see that as a barrier to trying something new and creative. This is certainly a problem in the state of Oregon of gigantic proportions. And I think the simple fact that we're looking at this a little differently, may serve us very well. I'm not sure you have all of the complications yet, but I just think it's a good idea for us to move ahead with it.
Further discussion? Representative Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support this here and on the floor. I do want to thank Mr. DiLorenzo for addressing the concerns some of us had as to the impact not only on Portland schools, but schools throughout the state, and I think that's a good fix to that. The bottom line is, unless somebody comes up with a better way to deal with this Superfund cleanup, we spend years in litigation before we actually get anything done. Has it worked nationwide? Yeah, but it's worked damn slow. And bottom line here should be clean up the river. And this is, I think, an innovative approach that I think may very well turn out to be beneficial for the people of Oregon. I'm not so much concerned personally as to where the liability falls here. I think one of the parties that's getting off rather easily here may be the state of Oregon, but I'm more concerned with the fact that we don't, on the front end of this siting process, spend years in court and not fix the river. So any opportunity we have to fix the river without going to court, I think, is worth exploring.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support the bill today. I work with special districts who have used this concept to take care of other problems, and I'd like to give it a try, knowing that we'll be able to revisit it, those of us who might still be here, and watch over the process. Thank you.
Further comments? Representative Palmer.
I guess I would just say that I think this is a very proactive bill. It's creative and it's innovative. There's always risks when you try something new. It is a redirecting of taxes. I believe that the Senate will continue the work that we've done here. This is the beginning of the work. I think what we've learned here is there are costs to produce anything. You don't get something for nothing. Everything costs you something. If you want a strong economy, if you want jobs, if you want to produce things that you can sell, it costs something in the environment. And so obviously we have to balance that. I don't think that we need to stop production, though. We need to move forward. We need to use our technology to do the best job we can in using our resources. So that's why I think this is a good approach to take.
Okay, clerk will call the roll.
No.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Kafari?
No.
Representative
King?
Yes.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. No. Aye. Both aye. Motion carries. Speaker Simmons will carry the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Half.
I'd like to serve notice of possible minority report.
What a surprise. Thank you, Representative House. That is your prerogative.
I will join him on that.
Is there anything else for the good of the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.